every 2 months, we are featuring one of the research projects that's going on at the center. Our goal is to give you a window in on the very fascinating issues that our scholars are studying and about which they're writing and speaking. And we wanted to be able to do something a little bit more intimate where you would have closer contact on a more regular basis. The scholar that we're featuring today is Josephine Johnston. She's a lawyer on our staff who's an international expert on the ethical, legal, and policy implications of human reproduction, genetics. She's also done a lot of work in neuroscience and psychiatry. And the topic that we're going to be talking about is this next generation of very new prenatal tests that are going to revolutionize the experience of pregnancy for the 4 million American women who get pregnant every year. Josephine Johnston, Josie, as we call her, directs our research department, and she's also one of our staff scholars. She heads up our Children and Families program area, and she currently won a very prestigious $1.1 million grant from the National Institutes of Health. Through this grant, we are going to be making policy recommendations about how best to use new prenatal tests that are going to give prospective parents more information than they've ever had before, and much earlier in pregnancy, well before most family and friends would know the woman is pregnant. We've had fascinating meetings in Garrison at our center already on this part of the project, and we wanted to share some of what the issues are with you. So I'm going to be chatting with Josie for the first 20 minutes or so, and then we're going to open it up to questions. Before we start, there is still background noise. There's a beeping, so if you haven't muted your phone, please do. Okay. So, Josie, let's just launch into this and maybe begin by having you tell us about these new tests. What do they do, and how are they different from amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling, which we've been using for decades?
Hello, everybody. Thanks for featuring my work on this call. So, you know, as Millie said, for decades, for several decades, we've done two types of tests prenatally, screening tests and diagnostic tests. And the diagnostic tests are amniocentesis and chorionic villus sampling. And anyone who's had those or who's learned about them a little bit knows that they're a test where a sample is taken from the woman's body of the fetal cells. And so they are invasive. They involve a needle incision, and there's a small risk of miscarriage associated with those tests. And there've also been these screening tests, which are designed to identify women who are at higher or lower likelihood of having the conditions that the amnio can then diagnostically test for. So both the new developments are actually sort of both in the Department of Screening and Diagnostic Tests. The first, and they're both driven, these new developments, by advances in genetics generally. So one of the changes is that we can now learn a lot more than we previously could from the cells that are taken in amnio or CVS. So it's actually possible now to do whole genome sequencing of the cells that are taken and therefore learn information about the fetus's entire genome, and creating this question about how much of that information to return to pregnant women and their partners. The second development is that there is a new screening test that can tell us a lot more earlier in pregnancy with, for most conditions, greater accuracy than the old versions of the screening test. And this new screening test is sometimes called non-invasive prenatal testing, sometimes called cell-free DNA testing. And it involves taking a sample of the mother's blood. And that's all that needs to be done in order to run this screening test. And the reason is that they have known for fair amount of time, but have just recently worked out that there is how to analyze. There are pieces of the DNA from the placenta and from the fetus floating around, circulating in the blood of a pregnant woman. And it's pretty incredible. After she gives birth, pretty quickly, those fragments of fetal DNA are cleared from her bloodstream. But when she's pregnant, there are fragments of fetal DNA floating, circulating in her blood. So if you take a blood sample, you can find these fragments. Now, they're fragments. They're broken up. But companies and scientists have worked out how to analyze those fragments. And come up with, in many cases, some fairly accurate predictions of whether or not the fetus has certain conditions. And to begin with, those were just the same conditions that we've been screening for a long time. So those were the trisomies, trisomy 13, 18, and 21. And trisomy 21 is Down syndrome, and so that's the condition that most people are familiar with in the prenatal context. But as this technology develops, more and more can be learned from those fragments of fetal DNA, and it's actually been possible in a research context to piece the fragments together and sample the entire genome of the fetus. So the prospect is that we'll be able to do whole genome sequencing of a fetus with this blood test, which can be done in an obstetrician's office at 10 weeks pregnancy. So that's the kind of future that we're looking towards and what we're asking about in our project.
Josie, so you're saying that we can do whole genome sequencing of fetuses. We can have all this genetic information during the fetal stage. How much information can we really get from that, at least at this point?
Right, so it's great to point out the difference between able to sequence the genome and being able to understand what that actually means. And we've come a long way in understanding what the information means, the data from the sequence means, but it's certainly not complete. But that said, we can identify genetic variants that are associated with risk, increased risk for certain conditions, like we can identify the BRCA genes, the genes that are associated with increased risk for breast and ovarian cancer. We can identify those in any sequencing, so we could definitely identify those in a fetus. We can identify genes that we know have will certainly lead to a disorder. So we can identify the Huntington's disease gene, which has 100% penetrance. If you have the gene, you will get the disease. But also ones where the genes confer elevated risk. We can also find out genes that are associated with adult onset conditions, like Alzheimer's, that are associated with increased risk for Alzheimer's, or genes that are associated with increased risk for childhood onset disorders, like certain childhood cancers. We can look, find out information about genetic variants or chromosomal disorder differences that are associated with conditions that have a huge variety of ways in which they present. So even something like cystic fibrosis varies greatly in how it actually manifests in a person, but there are other examples of information that can come back from these prenatal tests where it's very difficult to say exactly what it will look like in the child if the child is born. So can vary greatly from certain conditions that come with a mild learning disability or a slight reduction in expected IQ, but where the child might actually function quite normally, but or where they have autism or other conditions. So you might have a variant and it has a very wide range of potential impacts on the person. And then there are genes that we can act on where we have a treatment and ones where we don't, and so there's a lot of variation there too. And then there are genes or gene variants that are called variants of unknown significance or variants of uncertain significance, where it looks like there might be some increased risk associated with that variant, but it's not completely clear to scientists yet, and there's debate about whether to return that kind of information too. So there's a huge variety of information that can come out of this.
So Josie, you've mentioned a lot of things that are related to disease or what you call conditions like Down's or autism. What about non-disease traits?
The most obvious one of those actually is something that we've been testing for, screening for a long time, which is sex. So these tests return sex information about whether or not there are two X chromosomes or an X and a Y, or actually whether there's even some other difference, like sometimes people have three of those sex chromosomes, but certainly they're returning information about sex, which is not usually a disease-related trait. But there is genetics research that's looking at the genes associated with eye color, some related to athletic ability. There's a lot of research on the genetics of intelligence, and there's a lot of interest, understandable interest in trying to identify genes that are related with increased intelligence, and there certainly is research on genes associated with decrease. So there's other traits, other kinds of aspects of who people are being investigated using genetic methods and could be the kinds of things that would be offered. Now, those are often a very small effect, so very tiny increases in certain kinds of behaviors, but you know, that research is going on, and there certainly could be a market for those kinds of tests.
Although we still, our knowledge of the association between genetic variants and these more complex human traits is quite small at this point.
Incomplete, for sure.
So let's transition. Thanks for summarizing what's going on in the science and the technology. What do you see as the major ethics questions?
So at the end of the day, or sort of taking a very big picture approach, I think that some of this really asks us to think about who should be born and how relevant genetic information is to decisions like that. And who decides those kinds of things and how much choice we want to have about what we know and what we do with that information in terms of, you know, deciding who is born and who isn't. So there are big ethics questions there.
So are you saying, for example, you mentioned adult onset disease. I can imagine as a woman I would be, you know, quite torn if you told me that the fetus had a heightened risk for an adult onset disease. How much weight should I give that? I mean, if we were going to terminate pregnancies on the basis of something that might has only a heightened risk for something terrible, but only a heightened risk, and all of us have to die from something, I'm not sure how much weight I would put on that, but I think I'd have some sleepless nights.
The other thing about that information,
when you say who should be born, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and who should be born, and also who decides how relevant that kind of information is. So one of the other things that you raise in that example is that we know from studies on adults, that a lot of people who have a family history of breast cancer, and maybe you might think would be great candidates to be tested for those genes associated with elevated risk for breast cancer and ovarian cancer, choose not to be tested. Same for Huntington's. And we let adults decide that they don't want to know certain things about their genetic makeup. And so there are famous genetic scientists who have had their genome sequenced but have asked not to get back any information about elevated risk for Alzheimer's because they don't want to know that. But if you're thinking about this in a prenatal context, then the pregnant woman, you know, has the option, you know, if these tests expand in these ways, to find out things about the fetus that an adult might not choose to find out about themselves. So that's a really interesting ethical dilemma.
What about sex? We've been able to identify sex for a long time, but often much later in pregnancy. Are there norms now around terminating for sex of the fetus reason?
Well, I mean, there's no law on that in the United States, so there's no law against. So the law in the United States around termination of pregnancy isn't associated with the reasons for the termination. So in some countries it is, actually, but in the U.S. it's not about the reasons. So we don't ask those, we're not supposed to ask, and it's not supposed to matter, why the termination is being requested. And so we don't really know, it's very hard to research, how often people are having a termination based on unwanted sex, so that the sex of the fetus is not what they're looking for. But certainly in other countries, there's a little bit more data on that, and it's not a very frequent occurrence. And there's a growing market for sex selection, actually, in the IVF context, so even before you have a pregnancy, doing that with embryos. But in both cases, it's not a huge trend, but it certainly raises this question of, like, well, how relevant is this information, and what if people were going to use it to terminate? How would we feel about that? Because it is socially considered to be, you know, fairly irrelevant in terms of how, of whether or not the pregnancy ought to continue. The sex is not supposed to be, or the norm around in our culture is that's not a reason for a termination, even though it legally could be, and we really actually don't know how often it happens.
Although anecdotally, I believe there are some physicians who refuse to do so, as matters of personal conscience. Josie, I want to move on to the project, but before I do, I just want to push a little bit on this. I mean, it sounds quite exciting to be able to know all this, and it is exciting. And I certainly, if I were at that age, I would be very interested in this. But there's also, because you're saying that it does raise ethics questions, and the major thing you focused on is this question of who should be born, which is hugely put, say a little bit more, What is there any harm in having this much information? I know you've worked, for example, with Wendy Chung at Columbia, and she shared with you some cases that she found particularly difficult that had to do with how much information is now available and how uncertain it is. Could you give some examples before we move on to the project?
So I think it's
find out everything?
Yeah, it's tempting to sort of think about yourself getting a physical, and you're like, well, of course I would want to know if there was, you know, if I had elevated cholesterol or something, like, why not just return all that information? So it's tempting to apply the way we think about sort of your annual exam at the physician with this kind of thing, kind of test. And that some of the reasons why I don't think it's a completely perfect parallel are that we know from research on the first generation of prenatal tests that the experience of receiving information in pregnancy varies greatly. And some people find this kind of information very distressing and wish that they hadn't known everything that they were told. So we've got some data to show that not everybody welcomes receiving a huge amount of information in pregnancy about the genetic makeup of the fetus, that it can feel as if the pregnancy has been medicalized in a way that they aren't always happy about. And some people can feel that it creates sort of a path that they didn't think hard enough in advance about stepping onto. So the path being that you are screened, if you have elevated risk, you're diagnostically tested, and then you make a termination decision. And so the ethical argument has been that people should really have a choice about whether to step onto that path, whether to begin that process, which would mean that you would have a choice up front about whether you really are tested, whether you find out all this information, and maybe even some say over how much information you want to get back. So right now, you don't want to know the sex of your fetus when you go to your scan or for a test. You know, the physician will sort of hide that information from you. It's sort of almost like a game. It's like, oh, you don't want to know that. That's going to be a surprise. Like, we, you know, sort of we'll do that. The question is, do we allow people more choice than that? Do we allow them to say, like, I only want to know these kinds of things. I don't want to know these other things. These don't matter to me. Or, you know, this is my pregnancy, and I'm already worried enough, and I don't want to be overloaded with a lot more information that I might find worrying. It's also the case that we do know that it's hard for women to shake off information, even if it's later shown that it cannot be true. So if you do have an elevated risk in a screening test, and then it turns out diagnostically, you have a diagnostic test and it shows that you're clear, that you don't, that the fetus doesn't have that genetic marker, there's research showing that many women continue to worry about the pregnancy a lot more than they would have otherwise, because they think something must have been wrong. So it can be very hard to unknow things, very hard to shake off information. And the idea up until this point has been that women should have a lot of control about whether to be tested and what to be tested for, and then what to do following the result. But then research showing that a lot of women feel that there are very strong implicit messages about what they really ought to do, and they don't feel that they have as much choice as we would sort of ideally have liked. So our project is trying to ask, like, is this model of giving people a lot of choice going to work? How's it going to work? And what have been problems with that in the past? So if you routinely test, very hard for people to feel that they really have a choice, for instance.
And another outcome will be providing guidance to physicians so that they can shape these choices for women in a more productive and supportive way. Maybe you could just say a sentence or two about the project, who you've brought around the table, and what you hope the outputs will be.
Sure. It's a 3-year project, and we are developing analysis and recommendations. So we're trying to conceptualize, clarify and conceptualize, and then also offer recommendations. We have a huge number of people involved who are researchers gathering scientific and medical data, but also gathering, interviewing patients, interviewing physicians, but people who are doing that work already are involved. And then we also have people who are representatives or leaders in professional organizations like the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology or the International Society for Prenatal Diagnosis. We've got some of those stakeholders, core stakeholders involved, including patient groups involved in the project as well, so that we can come up with something that speaks to them.
And I have to say, that's very typical of all of our projects. We bring right in at the beginning the people for whom these guidelines are intended, so that they're co-constructing them with us, and their dissemination and uptake is much more likely. You know, our modus operandi is to develop very interdisciplinary groups where we are educated by the scientists and engineers and people in biotech on what they're doing, and then we bring our philosophers and our bioethicists and others outside of ourselves to really try to understand these issues and make sure that they can be bringing the benefits that they can bring. So thanks very much. So that, I think that concludes, and I want to thank everybody for joining us.